Glad to be together to study from the Word of God. Studying from the Bible is not something that we choose to study from. It is something that we know that we study from because it's the book from which we find all the answers. And we have focused all of our attention in the course of our time together this week in the fifth chapter of the book of Matthew in looking at eight simple statements that are made by Jesus that even to people who are not that familiar with the Bible and people maybe who aren't churchgoers or spiritually minded, chances are they are still going to be familiar with these eight statements that we call the Beatitudes. And we have encased our study this week as the idea of how we get to real happiness that is lasting and that is meaningful. And so we're going to turn our attention to number six in the list of eight. And if you're like me, as you get older, time begins to go quicker and time begins to fly. And here we are now, well over halfway through the list of the eight key things that Jesus has stated. Just be glad that Jesus didn't list 16 or 20 Beatitudes. Just think how long the preaching would be. But in many ways, it's symbolic of the fact that Jesus is pretty simple and his message is not complicated. And indeed, as we've said, if you follow these eight things, you will be on your way to being the kind of child of God that he's wanting us to be, and as we have seen, redeemed. Glad you're here. It is always good to be with brethren and to be with people that we've come to know over the week and over the years. And hopefully what we're doing this week will be pleasing and helpful to you. We are focusing our attention on the Beatitudes, and you may be tired of this by now, but just to make sure that we understand what we are doing, we're focusing our attention on the series of statements, blessed are the blank, for theirs will be the blank. And that's the story that Jesus is telling. These are the first statements made by Jesus in the single longest recorded sermon in all of the New Testament. It's the idea where Jesus is suggesting that if you want to be happier, more fortunate, or have a more meaningful life, here are things that you should consider. Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, and he used the term, happier is a person. And the word that he uses there is the same word that Jesus is using when he says, blessed are those who are poor in spirit, when we began Sunday. And so, for example, as we look tonight in verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, we could say, happier are you if you are pure in heart, or happier are the people who are pure in heart. And the other thing that we have said in each of the preceding five sermons is that the happiness that God is providing for us is not the kind of happiness that we would get by following the advice in the world. But rather, it's the kind of thing that when we put God first and put his principles first, then the happiness and fulfilled life comes our way. And so we turn our attention to verse 8. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Each of these statements are simple, straightforward, short, to the point, and beautiful to read, and wonderful to hear. So what we are going to do tonight is to take this very simple statement and basically say, let's camp in verse 8 for our entire evening. And let's explore everything we can so that we understand what Jesus is saying. In order to do so, there are a couple of things that we have to say, make our goal. One of those goals is to understand what the heart is, because an understanding of the heart is fundamental, not just to this beatitude, but if a person has a misunderstanding of the heart in biblical literature, the person cannot understand the Bible. So much is said about the heart being in the right place, your heart being far from where it should be. Make sure that your heart is right with God, a song that we sang this week. If we don't understand what we mean by that, then it's going to be difficult to apply what Jesus is saying here in Beatitude number 6. We need to remember the backdrop of Matthew chapter 5. And that is one of the best ways to appreciate Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is to read the last couple verses of chapter 7. That when Jesus was done speaking, the people who had surrounded the mountain were astonished because he taught as one who had authority and not as one of the Pharisees or the scribes. And so everything that Jesus is saying here is going to be a jaw-dropping experience where the average Jew, man and woman, is thinking, we haven't heard anything like this. Because what Jesus is telling me, the common Jew, is that I can be pleasing to God. I like hearing that better than what the Pharisees had been telling me for the last couple of years, and that is I'm a great big nobody because I don't have their wealth, their training, their expertise, or their property. So Jesus is attacking the heart, knowing full well that this is going to be confrontational because the Pharisees have their own serious heart issues. We need to make sure that we understand what purity is about. So we're going to try to define that. We're going to talk about what it means to see God, and then we will conclude our study this evening, as we have done through this entire series, by walking away with a couple of key applications that will help us. I want us to start, though, with the heart. I think, by and large, that we understand what the biblical heart is. We are not talking about the organ that is necessary for life so as to provide blood circulation. It is not something wherein there can be an attack. It is not something that there can be a transplant. But at the same time, there can be a spiritual heart attack. And in some ways, there can be a spiritual heart transplant. In many ways, Jesus, who calls himself the great physician, is in essence saying, let me do open heart surgery on you when you become a Christian and take out the old one and give you a new one. But it has everything to do with our attitude, the way in which we perceive things and the way in which we believe things. And so when we talk about the message of the gospel, it is important that we understand the message of the heart. Let me share with you two passages, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. The Old Testament passage comes from the book of Proverbs, a series of very important, down-home, wise sayings by the great King Solomon. And after a lifetime of experience, including making mistakes, he says in verse 23 of chapter 4, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. Well, this is the notion wherein, indeed, what you think about is what you are going to do. Where you allow your thoughts to dwell is what you will allow yourself to become. That is, if you want to know where life springs from, it comes from those things that are in your heart, which is why you are to be diligent in keeping your heart. In Matthew chapter 23, the New Testament passage that I think is so key to helping us understand this, is where Jesus says in chapter 23 and verse 27, in a series of woes to the scribes and Pharisees, where basically he is saying, the way in which you have conducted yourselves, it is wrong, and you need to change course. And he does so here in verse 27 by saying, whoa, hang on here. Scribes and Pharisees, you are hypocrites. And here's why you are like hypocrites in verse 27. He says, you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all that is unclean. And he goes on to say, even so you also outwardly appear to be righteous, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You could take that word inside and insert the phrase in your heart. But in your heart, Jesus is saying, you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. And so the word hypocrisy is used more here than it seems in any place else in the New Testament. Incidentally, do you know who the most prolific individual in the New Testament was who used the term hypocrite or hypocrisy, or the one who most often called others hypocrites? It was Jesus. And if you know your Bibles well enough, or you've done some Bible trivia, guess how many times a person has been called a hypocrite in the New Testament, and it wasn't Jesus speaking? Less than one. Zero. There are zero occasions in the Bible where someone says a person is a hypocrite, and it's not Jesus. And so we've got to remember that Jesus is the one who really has this uncanny ability to see into a person to know whether or not they are really a hypocrite. We can sometimes use the evidence to say, I don't think that person is very genuine. But ultimately, Jesus is the only one who has the ability to know that. And he knew that if a heart was right, it was right. If it was wrong, it was wrong. And a focus on the heart, on the inside, on the attitude, is in direct conflict with the focus on the things that these men, the Pharisees and scribes, were challenging as being important. And here, 2,000 some years later, not much has changed. People are concerned with their outward appearance and with their wealth. And so the idea is if I look as if I am wealthy, if I look as if things have gone well in my life, that's going to gain me the kind of respect that I deserve, or at least that I want, and people will think highly of me. Jesus is saying, don't worry about those things, and instead, I want you to just worry about the inner man. Or what about earthly intelligence? The fact of the matter is I would not disagree that being intelligent or acquiring skills or trying to be wiser or more academically gifted, that's a fair thing to do. And no set of parents says, well, I believe that education is unimportant. I believe that education is important. I'll tell you how smart I am. You know how many degrees I have? I have a lot of degrees. I have 98.6 of them. On a warm day or when I'm feeling sick, I get a lot smarter, and I have more than 98.6 degrees. But the fact is how smart you are or how intelligent you are, those are things that matter, and those are the things that matter to the Pharisees. But Jesus comes along, he says, I don't care if you can't do math. I don't care if you do believe that 2 plus 2 is equal to 4, because we all know that 2 plus 2 is equal to 5. We understand, and I have to be careful when there are kids, because sometimes the parents get upset with me when I use an illustration like that. But if you can't put two and two together, Jesus says, I don't really care. That doesn't matter to me, because I don't want you so focused on the outward things. And the same thing about a family pedigree, the idea of who your parents were or where they went to school or the kinds of homes in which they lived. And you know what? The very people that Jesus is in essence attacking or putting on alert with this Sermon on the Mount, they are the people who thought a lot about wealth, thought a lot about education, thought a lot about who their families were. And he comes along and he says, you know what? You are putting on this act, because that's what hypocrisy is. It's putting on a mask and playing the role of someone that you're not. He says, you are putting on an act, trying to deceive others to believe things that are not true. I would rather you just be transparent and be honest with others so that they see you for who you truly are. And Jesus says, what I want them to see is you as a pure person, a good person, and a person who understands the essence of a clean heart. Note that many who would have been sitting there on the mountain would have found this message so refreshing and so new. You mean, Jesus, I don't have to be rich? No. You mean I don't have to be real, real smart and I don't have to talk real good? No, that doesn't matter. You mean that I don't have to know if my parents were ancestors of a great person in the community square? Jesus says, those things don't matter to me. To understand why it is that Jesus says being pure in heart is so vital, we need to know why the heart is so important. And I want you to very, very quickly consider three reasons why it is that the heart is so very important. Number one, the heart is important because the heart is all about one's intention. That is, if a person makes a mistake, and we oftentimes use an adjective, an honest mistake, we don't typically get real upset with that person. Perhaps if they make that mistake over and over again, yes. But an honest mistake is something that all of us have made, and we are willing to cut ourselves some slack in regards to it. It reminds me of what Paul says to the church at Rome in Romans chapter 8 and in verse 27. He says, God is the one who searches the hearts, and he knows what the mind of the Spirit is because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. I like the first part. He searches the heart. God knows your heart, and God knows my heart better than anyone else, and I'm convinced better than we ourselves know our hearts. And so the heart is all about intention. We sometimes would say, well, he did that, but his heart was not in it. Or she took the job, but her heart wasn't in it. We understand what that means. On the outside, it looks fine, but when you peel away and get to the inner part of the person, their heart wasn't there. So the heart is all about a person's intention. Secondly, the heart is all about a person's focus. If you just go a paragraph or two later in this, the great Sermon on the Mount, after Jesus delivers the Beatitudes, these series of blessed are statements, he later says in chapter 6 in verse 21, he says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." I'll tell you the first time that I remember that particular verse kind of sticking out to me was whenever I like refrigerators. I like looking at the doors. I like looking at the doors open. That's the best part. Refrigerator doors closed or sad. Open, happy. Closed, sad. Open, happy. So, but I spent a lot of time looking at refrigerators. In my Mammal Ping's house on the corner of Vine and Buchanan, I'd go to the refrigerator a lot, and she had Matthew 6:21 up there. And I remember even at age 7 or 8 looking at that passage and thinking about what did that mean? Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You know, even at 7, 8, and 9, we can figure out what that means. What that is saying here is what you focus on is what you focus on. That's what it means. What you think about is what you think about. And so if our heart is in the right place, in Scripture, in spending time focusing on spiritual things, then that's where our focus is going to be. And the heart is, thirdly, all about our action, which is very important because it goes back to something that we said a couple of nights ago, and that is a person can think great things and believe great things, but if a person doesn't put his money where his mouth is and there's no action behind it, there's very little good that is done. And so in Proverbs chapter 27, again, Solomon, the wisest man who would ever live, save Jesus himself, comes along and he says, "Let me give you some advice." And the advice he gives in chapter 27, verse 19, he says, "As in water, face reflects face, so a man's heart reveals the man." If you want to know what is in a person's heart, you can oftentimes get a good idea by seeing what his actions are, because it's a reflection. He's saying, just as you look into the quiet waters of a pond and you're able to see your face reflected, it's the idea that whatever your actions are going to reflect your heart. But what you don't want to do is to put the effort into putting on the facade, as the Pharisees were. They saw an image because they knew themselves as impure, and then they projected something that was different. The heart is central to who we are trying to be as the saint and who we must be as Christians. We understand the heart, but Jesus says, blessed are not those who have a heart, but blessed are those who are pure in heart. And so that means we need to understand what it means to be pure. Well, to start, remember that the first two Beatitudes, where Jesus is launching the kingdom and launching this great sermon, it is essential to understanding what Beatitude 6 is all about. Beatitude 6, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. What was number one? Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. What did we say that was? I am nothing without God. I'm bankrupt and worthless without God. Beatitude number two, my sin without God is serious, and the only way that I can fix it is for God to do some sort of miracle in my life. That was Jesus coming and dying and doing all the great things that he did. The conclusion is given the fact that I'm nothing without God and my sin is so serious, I am ugly, I am impure, I am with sin, and therefore I need someone to come and purify me or clean me up. The reason that we drink, quote, purified water is because someone, whether they be legitimate or not, has sold us on the idea that water that you otherwise would get from your tap is impure. Now, I'm not sure what shifted in the last 15 to 20 years in the United States, but the notion that there are people who are scared to death and think they are going to die if they get water out of a tap. We used to drink water out of a hose all the time, and I turned out okay. That's debatable by some. We grew up drinking water out of a hose or out of the tap, but now there are people who I think literally believe that they'll die as a result. By the way, we buy a bottle of water. I've just given up. I do it too. But the fact is they have sold us, and maybe there's some truth to it, that by having pure water, that's different than water that you would get from your tap. Well, what does it mean that it's pure water? It makes us feel better that when we drink it, that there's zero chance of something bad happening, where there would be lead in it, or whether there would be some sort of contaminant or bacteria. We want it to be pure. And so identifying purity is important because we have a condition of impurity and we need someone to purify us. So identifying purity is helped by understanding the opposite, and that is impurity. You know what one of the greatest examples ever of impurity is in a moral sense? It is that which is hypocrisy, because ultimately they are the same thing. Remember, if you would, the first century audience. Jesus is speaking here to some of his earliest followers. He's still developing this notion of what will ultimately be called Christianity. And these people are surprised to hear a message that is different than what the Pharisees have been suggesting. And Jesus is saying, guys, the people up there wearing those nice shiny robes, the ones that you think are pure and perfect and wonderful, they are faking you out. They are pulling the wool over your eyes and they are tricking you. You are being tricked. To really be pure is not to focus on your wealth or to focus on your education or your family or your place in society, but it is to do the things that my Father commands. Someone might say, well, what is it that your Father commands? Jesus says, well, I'm glad you asked. Now read the rest of the New Testament, because that's what the New Testament is doing. It's detailing all of that, because the greatest example of someone who is impure is someone who is a hypocrite. The greatest example of someone who is a hypocrite is the idea of a person who is impure. And so let us define or identify purity with three keys. And that is key number one. Purity is that which is without disguise. It's the absence of foreign ingredients, or I love this phrase, which I didn't come up with, but literally ulterior motives. We understand what it means when a person has a pure motive versus an impure motive. For example, we as Christians, we try to really work hard at having pure motives. And I think by and large, we do a decent job at that. Wherein you do good for someone else, you sacrifice for someone else, you invest your time in someone else, you take someone to dinner, you provide for someone's income, you as a church say, you know what, this person needs assistance, so we're going to help them financially or physically. And you do that not wanting anything in return. And in fact, I had someone say to me today as I tried to pay, because I felt bad about my sermon earlier this week, so I tried to give this person some money earlier this afternoon, and he said, you're taking away my opportunity of blessing. So I said, fine, give me the money back, and then I was happy. That's not really true. I was happy to give him it. I got in trouble for saying that. Wendy says, that makes you sound really stingy. That makes you sound horrible. But the fact is, I took that away from him. So I said, all right, here you have it back. But here's the thing. We know what it is to have an impure motive. Well, I sure want to talk to that person and see how he's doing. But it's not because I care about him, but it's because the last time I talked with him, he hired me to do some work at his company, and I got an awful lot of money out of doing that contract work. That's impure. I'm not suggesting that it's wrong to benefit from your brothers or sisters. And there's something to be said for using one another. If you can have someone fix your home who's a Christian who you trust and pay them the same amount as you're going to pay a complete stranger, more power to you. But the point is there's something to be said for impure ulterior motives. James 1:27 says, you want to know what pure religion is? It's to visit the orphans, to visit the widows. What is it that makes that so pure? Because when you go visit a widow, unless she's been given a healthy inheritance, chances are you're not going to get much from it financially. What happens when you go take care of orphans or you look out for those who can't look out for themselves? You're not doing it knowing that they're going to compensate you. You're doing it because it's the right thing to do. James says that's the evidence of pure and undefiled religion. It's without disguise. Secondly, a key is that purity involves a singular motivation. Look, if you would, at 2 Corinthians chapter 5 to help understand what I mean by that. Purity is a matter of singular motivation. In chapter 5 and verse 9, Paul says, "Therefore, we are making it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to him." That's a very straightforward verse. And what Paul is saying there is that no matter what we do in our lives, we have one goal. We have one aim, we have one motivation, and that is to please God. That's what purity is. And what happens is we can start serving God and have different ambitions or have different motivations. Now, there are additional benefits to serving God in various capacities. You feel good. Depending on what you're doing, you may even have some sort of financial compensation. But the fact is we are individuals who serve God because it is our aim to please him. And it reminds me of what Satan asked of Job, or asked God regarding Job. He says, "Would he serve you for naught? Would he serve you for nothing?" And I remember years and years ago, someone suggesting that would be like asking us, would we be Christians and faithful and go to church and read our Bibles and try to live righteously if there was no fear of hell and if there was no promise of heaven? Would I serve God simply because he's God and he deserves it? I'm not afraid of going to hell if I do wrong. I don't want to go to heaven because it's not even there. But I'm going to serve God because he's God. That's a tough thing to really think about if you're honest with yourself. But the fact is we serve God because we want to serve God. Key number three about purity is it's designed for us to go about mastering the great commandment. In Mark chapter 12, we know where Jesus, among other places, talks about the greatest commandment is to love God with everything. In fact, the two greatest commandments, love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and body. And then the second commandment, likened to it, is love your neighbor as yourself. You can make it even simpler than that. The first two commandments, love God and love everybody. If you do those two things, Jesus says what? You have fulfilled the whole. You have done it all. Well, in the book of Hebrews chapter 12, there's a comment that the writer there makes that I wanted to consider for just a brief second or two. And that is, we are to pursue peace with all people and holiness without which no one will see the Lord. The fact is when we think about loving God and loving others, purity is the idea of pursuing peace with all people, making it so that we are working towards holiness and without which no one will see the Lord. That kind of purity is simple, easy to understand, but absolutely essential to service to God. And it's absolutely essential to us being able to see God, which is the final component of understanding Beatitude number 6. Blessed or happier are those who are pure in heart, who don't act in a fictitional way, and who are real and transparent with what their motives are, for they shall see God. What an incredible phrase. I would argue that there are different ways of understanding what that means, but let me share with you two ways in which we could understand what it means seeing God. One is that by being pure in heart, we are allowed to, quote, see God in a temporal sense. When I say see God, I'm not talking about seeing him. And in fact, Scripture says no man has seen God. One day we will. And we'll know what he looks like and understand what that feels like. But the fact is purity, when we are pure in heart, allows us to see God in a temporal sense with the family. Think about the way the family is designed and how perfect it is. Think about the fact that we see God in that design. Purity allows us to see God when it comes to the Word. I mean, when you see the simplicity of the Word and you see how easy it is to understand, you see God. What about with the church? No man could have designed an organization like the church. And among other reasons, why? Because we are greedy, profit-driven people. Nobody would ever engineer an organization like this wherein we're giving our time, we're giving our resources, we are giving our money, we are investing our energy, and we aren't, quote, getting anything in return. Now, we know that we are. But from a business standpoint, someone who's truly looking at this from a self-motivated business standpoint, the notion of church bureaucracy makes no sense because no one's making money off of it. Well, there's a few of us who are making a handsome living. But the fact of the matter is you understand my point. This doesn't make sense in the eyes of the world. And you know what? Isn't it true that providence is seeing God too? In this life, we've had experiences wherein we were able to see the plan of God come to fruition. It could be that you wanted to date or marry a particular person, and that didn't work out. And at the time, you were hurt and bothered, but years later, you think, boy, I'm sure glad that didn't work out, and I'm glad that I found the person that I'm with. It could be that you interviewed for a job and you thought this is going to be the perfect job and I'll make more money and I'll have more prestige, and you don't get the job, and then you're upset, and then finally 6 months later you get another interview at a place that doesn't really have the allure. You get the job and you're like, how did I get this? And then you look back 5, 10, 15 years later and you say, I am sure glad I didn't get that first job because my life would have not ended up that way. Is that not God providing? By the way, Let me share something with you that may very well blow your mind. It may very well be the most dramatic thing you've ever heard in your life. That if you take the word providence and you take off the last three letters, erase the E, erase the C, and erase the N, look what word you get. Isn't that amazing? I'm kind of being facetious. I think you probably already got that. But I'll tell you something. I'd never thought about that till a few years ago. And one of the reasons I was thinking about it is because if you're like me, you've had discussions with Christians where you've maybe wondered about the providence of God because it is mysterious by its very nature. And there may be some who say, I don't know that I want to suggest for sure that there is providence of God. It is true that we can't see God working in our lives in the way at the time. Usually we can rewind and look back and say, I think he was involved with that. I think he took care of me in some way here. But we all, take away the three, if that bothers you, take away the three letters. Do you believe that God provides? And if you say no to that, then I can't help you. Well, I mean, I can, but it's going to require some time. We all believe that God provides for us. I remember in, I believe it was late May or June of 2001, that I had just graduated. I got my first interview, and it was at one of the most renowned, great reputation, great pay, Wayne Township schools, where great people have worked, and I was going to get a job teaching. And I went in for the interview, and I thought, I'm going to get this. And Ben Davis didn't hire me. Can you believe that? I can't believe it. Didn't get the job. I had one more interview that summer at a middle school. And for those of you that are middle school teachers, more thanks to you. I didn't want to teach middle school. And I didn't get the job. And I'm glad. 2 weeks before school starts, I have no job. And finally, I get a call from Crawfordsville High School. Crawfordsville High School. I had spent some time there because I'd been there for 4 years already. I'll go do the interview. I get the job teaching something that I didn't want to teach because I was horrible in that subject. But I faked it for a while. And then I went back to school and got some more. I ended up staying there for a long time. By staying there, I ended up staying with the church for 6 years. Staying with that church for 6 years linked me with family who had friends and family in Southern California, which then meant I started traveling to Southern California. 20 trips over the course of 6 years. After about trip number 14 or 15, I said, you know what? This is getting too expensive to go back and forth. I should just go and stay. So I did, once there was an opportunity. Found an opportunity to work with a church there for 7 years. Found a lady there. If I would have gotten what I wanted in May or June of 2002, or 2001, I'm sorry, I wouldn't be here. And just think how disappointing that would be. I mean, what would you be doing tonight? So you see, you go back, and all of us can do that with our lives. I think somehow I see God working in my life, helping me in ways that are just kind of mind-boggling. No, all three exist, that is, without purity. But the beauty of their importance only comes into greater focus when we see where God fits in. That is, the family is beautiful without purity. Without purity, and you can have impure word, you can have impure church, but they are really spectacular when you see them in that way. But the thing is, I believe when he says they shall see God, it is also in an eternal sense. When John writes his three letters, one of the things he says in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2 is he says, "Beloved, we are children of God. And it has not yet been revealed what shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him even as he is." What's John saying there? He's saying we don't yet see everything, or we have yet to experience all the blessings, but we will. John is making this promise to believers, to fellow Christians, to fellow saints. This is something that you and I can take to the bank. That John is saying here, one day you're going to see God in a way that you've never seen or experienced him before. And you're going to look back, if you have a memory about life on earth, and you're going to say, I would have never dreamed it had been this wonderful, this beautiful, or this spectacular. I have a suspicion, because all of us have dreams of what heaven looks like or what it's going to be like to be there. I have a feeling that if we have those conversations here in this life, that then on the other side, when we have those conversations, we're going to shake our heads and laugh at each other and say, that was the silliest way of trying to describe this. But I can't describe it. It's really indescribable. It is truly that wonderful. These first century Christians were not perfect men or perfect women. And the same is true for us. And the reason that I point that out is people who Jesus says, if they are pure in heart, will have the option of seeing God, are the same kind of men and women who made silly choices, had huge regrets, and had a lot of sin in their life. If they can see God, then so can I. And so can you. And I like that. I'm so glad that the Bible is not written to people who were perfect and written about people who were perfect, because it would be the most depressing book in the entire world. Here's perfect people, be like them, even though you know you can't. That's not the way it works. Well, the fact is we, you and I need to understand purity. So let me close with these five very simple takeaways. Takeaway number one, seeing God is not an impossible thing to do. Nor does it require us to be special by worldly standards. What did Jesus say? You'll be happier if you are pure in heart, and you will then see God. Jesus doesn't say that in order to see God, you have to do all of these spectacular things, or you have to be this spectacular person, or you have to achieve these spectacular things. You just have to be pure in heart. I'm not belittling the idea of what it means to be pure in heart, because that's big. But you and I all have the capacity to be pure in heart. We don't have to be special by worldly standards. Secondly, being pure in heart, guess what? You knew this was coming. It is not going to happen unless you practice Beatitudes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Beatitude number 6 comes after Beatitude number 5 on purpose. When Jesus says, "Blessed are those who are pure in heart, they'll see God," you're not going to be pure in heart unless you, first of all, are seen as worthless without God, see the seriousness of your sin, are gentle, are the kind of person who says, "I want righteousness so that I'm hungry and thirsty for it, and I want to be merciful to others." Once you've done those five things, then you can work at being pure in heart. But you can't be pure in heart when you're still working on those other things. Thirdly, understand that God is the purifier and not me. He's the one who has the ability to do that. Fourthly, I am responsible for my part in being purified. That's part 3, section 2. What I mean by that is God purifies us, but we have to do our part in allowing that to happen, because he's not going to purify an involuntary individual. Indeed, purer in heart, O God, help me to be. We understand that we have a part in that. And James tells us in chapter 4 of his letter, he says, draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. Well, that tells me that if I don't draw near to God, he's not going to get close to me. If I want to be pure and I want to keep God at arm's length, it's not going to work. And I think most importantly, and number 5, knowing is important, but caring is more important. Because remember, it's all about the heart. The heart and being pure in heart is not about having academic superiority or knowing everything. There's certainly nothing wrong with us trying to know as much about the Bible as we can. And we should. And that's one of the reasons why you're here, because I want to learn more. That's good. That's a good sign. After all, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. But people, you know what it says, don't really care so much about what you know as much as they want to know how much you care. A person may not be very knowledgeable, but have an awful lot of compassion and care. And if that's choice 1, and choice 2 is a person who has more degrees than 98.6, but doesn't care at all, I know who I want next to me. I know who I want, to borrow from our analogy earlier in the week, sitting in the mud with me. I don't care what you know, but I do want your heart to be in the right place, because I want you to care. That's what real happiness is all about. And the unfortunate thing is people in the world are striving for happiness in doing it in the wrong way, and doing it in ways to achieve a happiness that is limited, that is temporal, that is carnal, and that is based in this world. And that's what we are trying our hardest not to do. And we want to help you in that effort. The vast majority who are present tonight are already Christians. That is, we've already been baptized to have our sins washed away. But it's true that we are still a work in progress, and we're still working on being purer in heart, because we want to see God better in the future than we have done in the past. And if we can help you in that effort, we would like the opportunity to assist you. If you are here and you say, well, I'm not a Christian, well, now's an opportunity to become one of those, to say, I want to join with Jesus and stand shoulder to shoulder with others who are in service to him, and I want to be baptized, have my sins washed away, become a Christian, a new person. In Mark 16:16, Jesus says it's pretty simple. If you believe and you are baptized, then you're going to be saved. And if you're ready to make that commitment tonight and to achieve the kind of happiness that comes only from Christ, we'd love to help you. Let us know how we can help while we stand and sing at this time.